You told me before about a trip the band made in 1969 down to Chicago. What do you recall about that?
69. Well, we had several places in Chicago that we played. In fact, for a while when we were with Central Booking, the teen clubs up here had a monopoly. They were taking groups like ourselves and the Underbeats and the Del Counts, and they would take one Friday night each month and one Saturday night each month and pay us very little on the basis that they would explain, well, we're giving you a lot of advertising, we're keeping your name out up here in the city. So we'd end up, in our minds, kind of saying, well, gee, we're giving up a Friday night and a Saturday night where we make a lot more money anyplace else, but we are getting the advertising. And that wore thin after a while. So we finally decided that in some places we had played for percentage of the gate. And we thought, well, we'd like to do this with the teen clubs. Well, they chose to, I mean, they being Dick Shapiro and as our agents, they decided to pull all the teen club owners together. And in fact, the meeting took place, as I recall, at King Solomon's Mines at the club. We presented that, you know, we wanted 50% of the gate. Long story short, without getting into all the rhetoric, they blackballed us.
The teen clubs.
Yes. And they said, you won't play here in this town. And what we had done is we had had Central Booking put together some jobs and tentative situations in Chicago. So that's kind of where we started going down and playing the Rush Up and Over clubs. And we had one called the Wine and Roses and out north of Hera Airport. And there was also, there was a lot of, you know, some of these places were very colorful. In fact, Mother's, and that's still there to this day, which is like an underground cave. The walls are all cave style. That, I recall, was our first place because that was the first time we were told, if you're going to Chicago, make sure you take your union card with you. Don't go without it. And sure enough, we were in the middle of the second set when we saw these guys standing by the edge of the stage, and we stopped the second song, and it was like they were waving us down, and right away they wanted to see all the union cards, or that was, they were going to throw us out. That's how Chicago runs. Mm. So we started doing that, and it was kind of funny because that went on for a few weeks, and I'm trying to think of Locates was the first one to call us in North St. Paul and offer us 50% of the club if we would play exclusively for them.
Now, this was a teen club.
Teen club. Then we said, no, we don't want any part of owning a club or part of anything like that. Just give us 50% of the gate. And that didn't go over too well on a non-exclusive. And then the second one was the prison with Pat Raines. Pat called and he said, I won't do 50% because I have a much bigger building. And he said, you know, I draw in 1,100 kids. And so, and we said, no, we just want the same deal for everybody. And in this situation, Mike did most of the talking, did a wonderful job with it, because the end result of all of this was that when one cracked, they all cracked in a matter of a week or two, and we started walking in every place and getting 50% of the gate, which was huge for us back then.
When the band played in Chicago, did you meet with the same success that you had in the Twin Cities?
Yeah, we had a lot of fun down there. In fact, there was one point that, we were getting clothes down there and Piper's Alley that were just being brought over. In fact, we used to make a couple runs to go down there and buy clothes because they were coming in from England, from Piccadilly. And, back then it was the Velveteen, Edwardians, and all this stuff. So we'd run down there and pick up some clothes and see, refit the band and come back. But we actually, some of us were thinking about whether we should move to Chicago. Because down there, Rush Street and Piccadilly, it was a very happening spot at that time.
Rush Street is where all these clubs were located?
Not all of them. There were a couple of them that were on the outskirts of town. I remember the Wine and Roses was north of the airport. That was a kind of a strange place because it was actually, you pull up to it, and this had a lot of... there were a lot of hookers there, and there were a lot of pimps there, and so there were a lot of wild-looking cars out in the driveway. this was just a place, I guess, known for that. I didn't book it, but we used to play there, and the job was 6 hours. You'd play from 9 till 3. So we used to make kind of a game of it to see if we could play for 6 hours and not repeat a song. And we'd do that. Break at, you know, about 4 in the morning and go back and order up some food and eat and then go to bed while the sun's coming up.
How did the band travel? Did you have a band vehicle, a bus or anything? Or
no, we always put it between a, we always had a truck for all our equipment with the our roadies that took care of that, and everybody else we went in our cars. So we always either, you know, we usually took two cars.
What kind of cars were what kind of cars were the band members driving?
Well, we probably at times spent more money on our cars than we had common sense. So I think at one time almost all of us either had an Eldorado or a Grand Prix. But if it didn't have a 5 foot hood, it probably or 6 foot hood, it didn't make it.
And you mentioned that there was a change in the business operation at one point. How did that come about?
Well, we ended up, I mean, we're getting into a point here where in 1968 to 70 that some of us are married and we're thinking about, you know, getting houses and other things. And, you know, as a musician, you can't really, you're not going to get much of a loan from a bank for real estate or a house. So what we ended up doing is we had a insurance guy. I remember he was out of Litchfield. And then we also had a couple other people that advised us, but we ended up getting the company, the group incorporated. We called it Mystics Incorporated. So we started with, you know, we had a corporation and we were agents, so we could say that we were agents working for this entertainment corp as opposed to musicians. It kind of legitimized us.
And the benefit was that running the band as a corporation would result in...
Well, you could, we ended up doing, you know, you get your normal check and, you know, a couple times a month, and then there was a bonus thing, and, you know, we had hospitalization, and, you know, it was a company type thing.
So 1969, I believe you said you had quite a few jobs in that year. Do you recall how many?
Something on the area of 320 nights that we played.
And these are all one-nighters?
Not all one-nighters. You know, some were three or four nights at a club. We'd fill it in town, or we'd do a week out of town in Chicago or whatever. For the most part, you know, we played a lot. In fact, some days we actually did more than one job. And in one case, I can remember we actually did three, where we did a style show, did a battle of the bands, and then split reel. We wanted to be first on the list for the battle of the bands so we could get to the third job. And then we went to B-Sharp Music and got the extra equipment we needed to pull it all off.
So you would have done Dayton's early in the day, and then a battle of the bands at Aldrich Arena.
Something like that.
And then after that battle of the bands, you would have done another job?
Right. I remember we did that at least one time. There were several times we did two jobs a night in one night. Definitely pushing it. I mean, nobody was happy about it, but then again, when you get your paycheck, you get over it.
Let's talk about the record Pain. How does that come about?
Well, I wasn't in on the initial conversations, but our Ira Heilacher was of Heilacher Brothers, and Ira was our producer. He had the idea of doing a record, and what he had worked out on this was... he pretty much came up with the whole idea. It was a song that the Grassroots had on an album, and it was coming to, they were looking at pulling it as a single. Some kid down in Iowa wrote it. From that point, he had also contacted Dayton's to pay for the record on the basis, and I don't remember the details, but they would have so much time and free copies or copies they could press to use for their style shows and giveaways. Before it was commercially released. And then he went to Metro Media Records out of New York, Bobby Sherman's label, and cut the deal with them for the release. Then at that point, we're brought into the picture where we're called and said, you know, we should get together over at Cookhouse. And we got the tapes. And I have to say that as far as the horn section goes, we elected to work out the horn parts after we got to the studio. So it wasn't like we were excited to record. But I look back on that and think we surely could have given it a more effort.
Have you heard the song by the Grassroots on their album?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't heard it until it was recommended that we record it.
So it was an album cut, so it was not being played on the local radio stations, I assume.
No, some stations were featuring it off the album, which is why ABC Dunhill, I believe, was Grassroots' label. And that's why they were planning on coming with it.
What time period was it when Ira talked to the band about recording the song Pain by the Grassroots?
I believe that would have been 1969, earlier in the year.
And do you recall how long you were in the studio for?
I believe we cut that in one afternoon. We simply went in and we worked on the horn arrangements, pretty much took the horn arrangements down similar to the existing cuts on the Grassroots album. Mike had worked on the vocal and stuff before, and other than that, we cut it pretty quickly.
And just for the record, who's playing on the 45 of Pain?
Mike Stokes, of course, singing lead and playing guitar. He had his brother Butch doing keyboard, Hammond. Then on top of that, there was Bill Lorden on drums, Willie Weeks on bass, did a great solo. Then there were the horn section being Greg Hartman. Greg played tenor. Dave played played trumpet.
That's Dave Hansen,
correct. Okay. And myself on sax.
What was the B-side of Pain?
It's All Right, J.J. Jackson's song. It was one of the songs we used to open up a lot of our sets with.
Mm-hmm. So Pain comes out, and my understanding is it comes out in 69 on the Charlie label.
That's not my understanding. I don't have any clue. I have a copy of that record on the Charlie label, but I have no idea what the Charlie label is. We were signed and under contract to Metro Media out of New York, and which was a nationally distributed record company. And that's what was distributed, and that's what the DJs are, and that's what I have at home.
Was the Charlie record a surprise to the band, or?
I don't know if it's a surprise to the band, because I've only seen the first copy about 2 years ago.
Did the record get on the local radio stations right away?
Oh, yes. Here we were number one for a number of weeks, and we were, I think, 67 or something of the top 100 of the year for KDWB. I remember when Trudon Blue left and went to California that he sent me their station copy, so I think that said number 67. And we also went number one in Buffalo, New York. Why? I have no idea. Who knows who out in Buffalo, New York? But those were the two markets that we hit, and it just didn't spread from there.
So in town, both WDGY and KDWB played it?
Oh, yeah. Every you heard it all the time. Mm-hmm. And nationally, it went to, you know, there's the Hot 100, and then there's the Overflow that they keep track of, and it was like 110 or 112, mm-hmm. something up there in the teens. It hit that, but it never got on the Hot 100.
Well, every band wants a hit record, whether it's local or regional or national. So you do have a hit locally. How does that impact the band?
Oh, well, obviously, it impacts the band very nicely as far as, you know, the jobs and what you're charging. I mean, everything goes up a little bit, makes you more popular when you're on the radio every 20, 30 minutes. It seems like that anyway.
Did your version follow fairly closely the Grassroots arrangement?
Well, you certainly know it's the same song, but not too much. I think ours was actually a lot better. But I'm biased.
Did that become the song the kids wanted to hear when they went out to see the band?
Did for a while. I mean, we certainly, you know, played it, kept it at the end of the set, and and used it that way. It wasn't probably as flashy as some of the other cover songs that we did, that we incorporate all the horns and arrangements and other things. But we had a lot of fun with it.
So, Wes, how long do you stay with the Mystics?
Well, I went up to New Year's night, 1969, 1970, that crossover.
So you remember the last gig?
The last job that I played with the band was at the barn in, what was it, Eden Prairie?
That's the Purple Barn?
Purple Barn, you got it.
In Eden Prairie, okay. And
in fact, that was the last night for me, the last night for Bill Lorden and Willie Weeks.
Was the band going through a transition at that time, or what was going on?
Well, Bill and Willie had given their notice, and they were leaving. They were going initially with some group on Mercury Records out of Canada, I believe. I thought long and hard that this would be a good time, as long as the band was being put through this transition of having to do things and bring new people in, that probably be a good time for me to step out also. I was looking at some other interests in life.
You mentioned a conversation you had with Corey Wells.
Well, yeah, earlier from that time, you know, as a sax player, what you kind of ask yourself is a little different than the lead singer or the lead guitar player in a lot of groups. And at that time, there were not any, I mean, the Mick Jaggers of the world weren't that old, much older than us. I mean, so there wasn't anything ahead of him. I mean, though that age group, there just wasn't anything out there. There weren't 60-year-old rock and roll players, in other words. There weren't 30-year-old rock and roll players at one point there. So you really wonder, where's the future? You know, playing sax, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun, and we got our Connie Awards and all these other things, and you kind of go, do I love playing? I absolutely love playing. And but what am I going to do when I'm 60 years old? Am I going to be in a trio in some smoky bar someplace? That may not be where I want to be. So I had some other passions, and I just happened to be backstage. We were front acting for Three Dog Night, and the subject came up, and it was just a brief conversation, but it was interesting because I was told, you have to go to California.
This is Corey Wells told you.
Yeah, and
this.
You know, you kind of go on with, you know, in a way that you can't necessarily do it from here, especially at that period of time.
So he's saying you have to go to California to make it big.
Right. And that's what I should do. And there were a couple people at that time thinking that way. I mean, we had been out there with a couple tapes and, you know, tried to get some people interested. And there wasn't this so-called Minnesota contingent that grew out there about 5 years later, where people had kind of an anchor of people out there they could go out and visit. And nest in with while they went for a record deal somewhere. So I ended up taking that choice, and the more I thought about it from that point, I started to think, well, I'm not going to California. I have some other passions, and as much as I love it, this was the time frame to step out.
So when you look back at your time period with the Mystics, is there any particular good memories you have of being with the band?
Oh, there's more than I can recount. I mean,
any highlights that?
Well, the highlights were, you know, playing the auditorium shows, and you know,
with the national acts.
Yeah, when we played with Aretha, I mean, you walk out on that stage, and you know, and sometimes you get so into it, it's like, you know, you could care less if you died, as long as it was 2 hours later. You know, I look at that as being small and minute. Next to thinking, you know, what do these national acts, you know, what does Queen or REO or Mick Jagger think when he's out in front of 100,000 people? I mean, that's pretty heady. But in its own way, you know, we experienced that on a very small scale, and it was very exciting for the time, and it's a memory you never lose.
So now it's 1970, and you're out of the Mystics, and what do you do next?
Well, my original intent was to go to the Minneapolis Art Institute for 4 years and get a degree in art. I'm one of those closet artists. And so I quit the band, and I was intending to do that. I don't know what happened. It was kind of one thing led to another, and the other horn players, Greg and Dave, called me, and we started talking, and then we started to think, gee, you know, why don't we put a super group together? And we were kind of thinking of something like Geech had with the Flippers, you know. I mean, there's a group, you know, and doing very well traveling. So we kind of used that as a, I guess today I'd call it a business model. And I got, we all got, I think, hooked into it. I think we hooked each other into it. And took the money I'd saved up for for school for 4 years and everything else. And we started a group called Mystic Evolution.
Mystic Evolution.
Right.
Who was in the band?
Well, started out with, of course, the horn section, Greg and Dave and I from the Mystics. And then we brought in, there was Tom Barnick on drums, Larry Weldon on bass guitar, Will Wampa on lead guitar and some vocals. We had a vocalist, I can't recall his last name, but his first name was Barry. Barry, that's right, from Iowa. He was out of Des Moines. We brought in a keyboard player, Dewey, from South Dakota, from Sioux Falls. He played trumpet with his left hand and played keyboard with his right hand and complemented bass with the pedals on the organ. I think that was it.
Barry is eventually replaced by Thaddeus?
Yes. Very shortly thereafter, Barry went back to Iowa, and Thaddeus, who had been with us in the Pastels, Thaddeus joined us.
And how long does Mystic Evolution last?
Well, we started out really strong. In fact, Pat Raines gave us the prison to hold up for about 3 weeks while we kind of on and off. We used that as a practice hall, and we put together a full three sets. Then we went out, and by the time we went out, we had bookings pretty solid for the first 90 days going out. So we were rolling pretty hard, and we went out, bought a bus and a Sun Coliseum PA system. We had that brought in from California, and that's where all the money went. And then we started playing, and I don't know what happened. In part, I know, the bus breakdowns, late for a job. We had, you know, personnel problems where we had to switch people out. And one thing just kind of led to another. And the worst was probably Big Blue, the bus. That thing was just a black hole, a money pit. We were just lucky that we didn't all die on that thing. But we probably 6-8 months later, we were financially done. We just called it. And at that point, I had pretty much spent all the money that I had saved up for college and for that art degree. And that's where I kind of ended up.
So that brings an end to your career as a musician, correct?
Well, I had one more. Can't believe I'm bringing this up. One more short stunt after that, and which I I'm trying to remember the name of the band. If the guys listen to this, they'll know, and I apologize up front for not remembering their names. But Trudon Blue from KWB, after I got into the record side of the business side of the record business, called me about a year after I was out of the band. And he said, you know, I do the Trudon Blue disband. And he'd have this band show up, and they'd play for 2 hours, and he'd come out and do two sets, two short sets. And he said, I want a sax player. It's all back to the 50s. And I said, I won't do back to the 50s. And so finally one day came when he kept, because we were good friends, and we kind of kept back and forth on this. I was promoting records to him. And he kept saying, okay. He said, I really want you. He said, it'd be a lot of fun. And he said, I'll drive. You don't have to drive anywhere. So I made this agreement. If I didn't have to play in town where anybody know me, I'd go out with them, and I'd play the fool and roll my shirt sleeves up with a pack of cigarettes in them, even though I don't smoke. And I'd go ahead and play all the yakety-yak saxes and everything else. And he paid me very handsomely for it, which I thought was nutty. I did it. He put on some of the craziest shows and goofiest things. I mean, and embarrassing things, even to people like us in those days, you'd ever imagine before he then went out to KHJ in Los Angeles, and now he's up in San Francisco. And actually, he went to Los Angeles when that broke, when he left town here and did the Gong Show for a while. So that kind of tells you what kind of personality he was. But that was the last time I played.
So it was a little different experience than playing with the Mystics.
Totally different than playing with anybody. It, I look back on it now, it was crazy. You just step in for 2 hours and you get in the car and you laugh all the way home thinking how nutty it was.
Wes, thank you for taking the time to share your memories with us about the Mystics.
That's very well. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The preceding interview was recorded on November 13th, 2011 at Sunrise Sound in Rogers, Minnesota, and was produced by Danny Johnson and Tom Campbell.